don't get you, brother.
Whitey, you and your punk friends killed my man.
You know, you got one of the prettiest asses in town. I'd sure hate to see it kicked in for accusing people.
I'm not accusing you, honk. I'm passing sentence.
You ain't reading me, are you?
And the sentence is death.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Santiago Boys. I'm Evgeny Morozov, and I'll be your host. In the last episode, we met Salvador Allende. He's just got elected president on this big utopian program. And funnily enough, he's even trying to implement it. His plans horrify the CIA. ITT, the tech giant, is not thrilled about them either. And they worry for a good reason. Allende, as we found out, is a bit of a dreamer. A guy who wants to give milk to all the Chilean kids. But it's not his milk utopia that Allende's enemies find so threatening. Rather, it's his proposed reforms. He wants to restore Chile's technological sovereignty. He wants to defend its economic independence. And that's something that his enemies will not tolerate at any cost. But it's not all gloom for Allende. He's surrounded by all these radical engineers, the Santiago Boys, who have a strange itch. They love technology, and they want to use it to help Allende. They too are a bit on the dreamy side. But as things get out of control, they seek help from this British consultant named Stafford Beer. He is quite a character. He's rich, he's got connections, he knows everything. Management, computers, even cybernetics, whatever that is. So it's shaping up to be quite a battle with spies, terrorists, leftist guerrillas, and so much more. And you'll hear all about it in just a second. Let's go. It's September 1971, a year after Allende's historic victory. We're in Viña del Mar, a gorgeous beach town not far from Santiago. It's the right place to take a boat trip and enjoy the ocean, but these guys, some of Chile's most powerful people, are not here to relax. They're here to plot against their president, Salvador Allende. And these rich industrialists, the owners of Chile's factories and mines and banks, hate him. They know they need to topple him, but they need help. Now, they already have some friends lending a hand. Friends who also hate Allende. Friends who have studied with Milton Friedman, the free market guru, and who now want to bring his ideas to Chile. These friends are called the Chicago Boys. And their vision for Chile's economy is very different from Allende's. But even more help is needed. And so these industrialists form an intelligence unit, a unit that will search for ways to damage Allende, a unit led by a former military man, a colonel, no less. This colonel and his man share their intel with a dangerous right-wing group. They call themselves Patria y Libertad, Fatherland and Freedom. They got a lot of money from the CIA after the election, and they're using it now to make Allende's life miserable, truly miserable. So miserable, in fact, that even the U.S. ambassador worries about them. In a memo he sends to his superiors in Washington, he paints a rather disturbing portrait of this new movement.
Publicly merely anti-Marxist and dedicated to mobilizing opinion in defense of Chilean democratic values, Patria y Libertad, in fact, seeks to enhance its capabilities as a paramilitary shock force and, ultimately, to provoke a sympathetic military intervention.
The ambassador doesn't like their look either.
PL chose as its symbol a black spider-like device, which brings the swastika to mind. Easily stenciled, this rather sinister insignia adorns countless walls in Santiago's middle and upper-class residential sections, Patria y Libertad's home ground.
The rhetoric of this new movement might seem mild and even vaguely anti-authoritarian, but in reality, the agenda is anything but.
The symbol is often accompanied by such catchwords as integration, authority, and functional democracy.
So, as his enemies multiply and even join forces, how can Allende possibly survive? And what could a clueless upper-class foreigner, the Stafford Beer character, possibly contribute? But when nobody expects it, Allende goes on the offensive and does something huge. He takes over ITT's subsidiary in Chile and locks up its bosses. Now, this makes ITT very angry. And remember, they have powerful friends. Friends in Washington. Friends like John McCone, who used to run the CIA itself and is now on ITT's board. And of course, they are ready to fight back. Hard, with all their might. Fight until they crush this dreamer. Stafford Beer knows none of this. At least he doesn't show it. He arrives in Chile with a big idea, but an even bigger appetite. Wine, pisco sours, empanadas, Stafford Beer wants it all. And at first, it's all going great. He mingles with Allende's inner circle, he frequents local bars and restaurants, he gets to know what is really happening in this country. And his host, Fernando Flores, is happy to help. Gabriel Rodriguez remembers the incredible dynamic between the two.
It was completely different from how a government bureaucrat would treat a foreign consultant. Fernando was absolutely sure about the value of what Stafford was working on.
Stafford also tutors these young engineers about the basics. You know, how to run their government like a British steel factory. How to make decisions based on data. How to get their cybernetic ducks in a row, so to say. That kind of thing. But it seems he's not at all sure they are buying it. But he worries in vain, as Raúl Espejo recalls.
He felt that he had to convince us and that we were going to be tough cookies. We were all with our mouth like that, you know, and just trying to get as much as possible from him.
You might think that lectures on management cybernetics would be, what's the word, boring? But not for these guys. Stafford impresses them with his big radical idea. He says that we can prevent big problems by spotting trouble early on. He talks about detecting incipient instability. Incipient is consultant speak for emerging, I guess. And he says this could change everything, absolutely everything.
If you know in real time that some aspect of your affairs is incipiently unstable, you can go and stop it.
So while Allende's enemies do their best to cause instability, Stafford is desperately trying to keep things stable. His brief is to keep the situation under control. These young engineers also love Stafford's vision of the computer as the Liberty Machine. That's what he calls it, the Liberty Machine. And in fact, they're hanging on his every word as he explains it. It all sounds wonderful, but can Stafford really live up to the challenge? Can he truly detect instability before it's too late? And can he prevent Chile from descending into chaos? All of that remains to be seen. For now, one thing is clear. In Chile, Stafford finds himself in a very strange new world. It's not exactly the life of luxury he's been living in the UK. The Chileans put him in the Sheraton Hotel, a place that's hard not to enjoy. And for a while, Stafford does enjoy it. Blissfully unaware, it belongs to ITT, the company plotting against his new bosses. Not exactly the kind of place where you'd want to leave your room unlocked and your documents unprotected. Still, the winds of change are blowing strong in Santiago, and Stafford cannot not notice it. The old way of doing things, all those rigid hierarchies and class divisions, all of that is being overturned. And for Chile, this moment offers a thrilling chance. A chance to reimagine how workers could relate to their bosses. A chance to empower those who really know best. And a chance to show that socialism, too, can innovate. Here's John Garces, Allende's top political advisor, explaining to us the blueprint behind this radical change.
Cada empresa tiene un comité de empresa que es elegido por los propios trabajadores.
As John points out, each state firm was supposed to be governed by a council of 10 representatives. 5 of them come from the government and 5 from the workers. The government does pick the ultimate boss, but the workers also form committees. And it's these committees that decide on almost everything. And this setup works amazingly well. The workers' productivity improves, and everything runs so smoother now. Now that they're motivated, the workers are also inventing new ways to cut costs, boost quality, and even develop new products. They're part of a grand experiment to take socialism to a completely new level. And luckily, now they do have a hidden ally. Yes, our own Stafford Beer. He wants to make the factory smarter. But that's not all. He also wants to connect them to, wait for it, computers. What? Well, yes, these computers will help workers manage their factories. That is, to become managers. They will not just be monitored and treated like cogs in the machine like in the old days. No. It will be completely new and different in this new Chile of Allende. So, dreaming big in his Sheraton room, Stafford is inventing a cybernetic system for socialism. A socialism unlike that of the Soviet Union. A different socialism. One that respects computers, and the workers too. And just like that, Project CyberSyn, short for Cybernetic Synergy, CyberSyn, is born. All of it courtesy of Stafford Beer, of course. This name takes a while to emerge, but the underlying ideas are already there during his first visit, as some of the founding documents show.
Objective: to install a preliminary system of information and regulation for the industrial economy that will demonstrate the main features of cybernetic management and begin to help in the task of actual decision-making by the 1st of March, 1972.
By the way, a minor digression here. There is a great academic book about the history of Project CyberSyn that I highly recommend. It's a book by Eden Medina, and it's called The Cybernetic Revolutionaries. The reference to this book, along with hundreds of other sources, including articles, documents, telexes, and even some videos, appears on our podcast website. Do check it out. And now back to our story. So the Santiago boys are buzzing with excitement as Stafford unveils his big plan. For them, as Aurelio Espejo points out, this is a chance to break out of the daily grind and become part of something truly exciting and revolutionary.
For us, it was a fantastic opportunity to get involved in something that was new, that was very impressive, and that it would take us out of the routine, traditional work that you would expect to have in these institutions.
The Santiago boys are living a dream. A dream where technology can transform reality rather than just help adapt to it. And what's more, they're doing it in a place where absolutely no one expected anything of the kind. The stodgy offices of Corfo, that bureaucratic monster. But to think it all began in a Sheraton suite? Well, maybe we've all been booking the wrong hotels, guys. The Santiago boys are in for a surprise. Turns out that Stafford's vision is even more expensive than they ever thought possible.
The idea was just this. If we could find points in the economy at which to measure things, those measures would be sent every day, continuously, to computers which could analyze them, produce answers.
One can easily get lost in this ambitious vision, but one has to wonder, does Stafford truly understand Chile? Does he have a clue about the realities on the ground? Only two computers for CyberSyn to work with, and no guarantees of acquiring more. And to make matters worse, Washington's meddling makes it nearly impossible to acquire spare parts and much-needed equipment. Equipment of any kind. Imagine, Chile can't even keep its copper mining machines running. How will they ever manage to maintain those clunky mainframes? But when there is a will, there is a way. As luck would have it, the Santiago boys find a hidden stash of dusty telex machines in an old post office. And now, with a little ingenuity, they can try to build a network to change Chile, if not the world. The internet before the internet, if you will.
What we did was we took over the telex circuit and we ran the most advanced socioeconomic control system the world has ever seen on about the most antiquated equipment you've ever seen.
We knew that any socialist revolution might start in the post office, but not quite in this way. As Project CyberSyn gets underway, tensions between Washington and Santiago reach new heights. Now Nixon is even more furious with Allende. How dare he claim that America owes Chile money? And how dare he do that after Allende himself has nationalized the country's copper industry, which was previously owned by American firms? That's some creative socialist accounting right there. Nixon is simmering with anger. He even orders Henry Kissinger, and I'm quoting here right from the royal lips, to knock their brains out, to kick Chile in the ass, and my personal favorite, to really blast their butt. He's one hell of a gentleman, this Nixon. Why is he so upset? For one, Nixon believes that Latin Americans are not yet mature enough not a democracy anyway. He worries that giving everyone there the right to vote would simply open the door to communism. Just look at Chile with Allende. They elected this guy in the democratic election. The strange attitude to the region started a long time ago, possibly in the late 1950s. The disastrous trip to Latin America only confirmed many of Nixon's biases. As one witty observer put it, it was a diplomatic Pearl Harbor, and Nixon was not the one waging the attack.
Richard Nixon visited a number of countries in Latin America in 1958 and was surprised to find that he was not very welcome.
This is historian Stuart Shader from Johns Hopkins University. On this tour, Nixon hopes to meet the common people, and much to his horror, meet them he does. Protests greet Nixon almost everywhere he goes.
In Lima, in Peru, in Nixon's own words, a weird-looking character, one of the most notorious communist agitators in Lima, spit in his face. And Nixon kicked this guy in the shins.
In Venezuela, where he goes next, everything goes wrong from the get-go. As Nixon and his wife disembark the plane, they're hit by a strange brownish rain. Turns out to be spit from tobacco-chewing protesters standing on the observation deck above. Then, as the Nixons drive into town, angry mobs attack their car with pipes and sticks. Situation is so intense, they almost overturn it. And here comes the train again. As the windshield gets covered in drool from all the spitting around them, the poor driver has to turn on the wipers. Nixon surely sees this as proof of the unfolding communist apocalypse. But for those around him, it's just a way to show their frustration. Frustration with US policies in Latin America. You know what they say. Don't spit on a foreign policy, spit on the guy who makes it. And Nixon is the only guy they've got. But Allende won't follow this riotous crowd. As the conflict between Chile and the US intensifies, he's even attempting to reason with Nixon. He crafts him a most polite letter, full of ideas and arguments, not threats of brain-busting and ass-kicking.
The harsh reality of our country, the hunger, the poverty, and the almost complete hopelessness has convinced our people that we are in need of profound changes. We have chosen to carry these changes out by means of democracy, pluralism, and freedom, with friendship toward all peoples of the world.
History plays out in mysterious ways, and the Cold War history especially so. The irony here is that Allende kind of admires America. He loves the poetry of Walt Whitman and has a fondness for Western movies. And politically, he even looks up to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Of course, Allende is hardly alone here. Just look at the young Fidel Castro, who was a 14-year-old even sends FDR an admiring telegram. But Cold War has other plans for Chile and for Latin America. It dooms Allende to be Nixon's enemy. Sadly, no polite letters could ever fix this. As Nixon and Allende battle it out, a group of socialist nerds can't wait to get into action. Their home? A most curious, almost magical place called INTAC. That's where CyberSyn gets its operational base. In English, its name would be something like the Institute of Technology Research. It's a government agency that works on solving technical problems for corporate state enterprises. But it's also a place where young and creative minds can run wild. And when Allende comes to power, they get a new challenge: how to make technology more socialist. This is where Gibbon Siepp comes in. He's a German designer who studied at the famous Ulm School of Design. Recruited by Fernando Flores, Guy joins the Catholic University and then moves to INTAC. So while he may be born in Germany, it doesn't take him all that long to reemerge as a Santiago boy. Now he just needs to figure out how to sprinkle some socialist pixie dust on everyday objects. This might seem like an easy task, but as Guy soon discovers, the road to socialist tractors and sofas is paved with unexpected challenges. The good thing is that he already knows all about Stefan Beer. He stumbled upon his work back in Germany, even before Fernando.
In 59 or 60, when I had finished my studies, a colleague of mine became employed as a lecturer and reader in the Fischer Verlag in Frankfurt. And the Fischer Verlag came up with a request to translate one of the first books from Safavir, Design Management.
Guy accepts the challenge, but it proves too daunting. His English is just not good enough at the time. But he loves the book and Stafford series.
He had a very, very strong influence of my way of approaching reality and of teaching design and designing, you see.
But there is only that much that a provincial German town can offer a young intellectual. Guy is longing for something wilder, something in Latin America, perhaps. A buttoned-up intellectual who is shedding his tweed jacket for a sombrero? Well, it's not an everyday occurrence. But Guy Bonsiep is up for the challenge. Ulm School may have taught him a thing or two about ideas, but Latin America teaches him about everything else.
Coming to a cosmopolitan, open, and vital city like Buenos Aires was like a shock. That you could go to cinema 24 hours a day, this was unusual for me, even unimaginable, but that was possible.
A casual trip to Buenos Aires turns into something bigger. Eventually, Guy moves to Santiago, feeling at home in a region ripe for revolution.
In Latin America, you could dream of a utopia. This was possible. In Europe, I could not dream of a utopia. Everything settled already, everything done.
His immersion in Latin American politics also makes Guy critical of how designers think about their profession and its responsibilities. Most of them believe that their job is to make objects prettier, to keep tweeting the design of the same car with every new model. But is it all that there is to it? Are they forever to remain these handmaidens of corporations?
Perhaps they had the prejudice that they say designers are, you know, not troublemakers, or confusionists, but they are cosmeticians, you see. They make nice products.
What about politics, ecology, economics? Shouldn't they too somehow appear on the designer's radar?
This was a very easy and misguided conception what design is about, but anyway, it existed there. Step by step, we could change this opinion or prejudice.
By that time, he has become a true Santiago boy. Like those students occupying the Catholic University, Guy believes that expertise comes with social obligations. Thus, while other Ulm graduates go to work for the likes of Brown or Olivetti, the big design brands, Guy visits Havana. He wants to learn about Che Guevara's influence on Cuban textiles.
And at least I, when I was in Chile, felt more at home being involved in projects which were coming from a social context and conditioned by a social context than from mainly marketing and private company interests, you see.
In this grand vision, the designer's job is not just to make pretty chairs. It's also to build a world where everybody has a seat at the table. No wonder that Guy had to come all the way to Latin America in search of this utopia. But translating Allende's socialist promises into actual technological reality proves no easy feat, especially when the expectations run so high.
One of the most iconic basic consumer goods to be associated with the Popular Unity Revolution was powdered milk.
This is Joshua Franz Trink, the historian of Chile at the University of Texas.
Nutrition scientists had identified Chileans' failure to consume enough milk as a sort of key reason for the country's very high infant mortality rates and generally for poor public health outcomes.
Allende's government sought to provide schools with packets of powdered milk that would then need to be mixed with water. But the correct dosing proves difficult. And in a country where every penny counts, these costs add up. Fortunately, Guy and his design team stand ready to help.
There was a spoon, a device to measure 5 grams and 20 grams of milk powder.
After a lot of prototyping, they arrive at an elegant solution.
And so finally, we got back to the basics, to make an open half sphere in which you simply stroke with a knife the excess of powder and you get what you need, you see.
These are the unsung heroes of Allende's revolution. They're quietly improving the lives of ordinary Chileans, one weird gadget at a time. Take, for instance, the impracticality of using wooden crates to store and transport fish, a big problem in a country of fishermen. Geese team developed a solution that is simple yet efficient: plastic crates that are water-resistant and easy to stack. Or take the furniture they design. It's furniture for the poor, furniture that will fit into the tiny, low-cost houses. The Chicago boys may be great admirers of the market, but this invisible hand has never bothered to provide it. So it's the visible hand of the Santiago boys that actually has to build it from scratch. They're thrilled to be working on Allende's techno-utopia. All they need is time. While Guy and his team are building techno-socialism, Stafford Beer is living it up by his poolside room at the Sheraton Hotel. And who can blame him? The lobsters there are delicious, especially when you know that they're being subsidized by ITT. Yes, socialist accounting strikes again. Like other establishments, the Sheraton has to accept the so-called popular prices mandated by the government. Stafford cuts such an imposing figure that the locals even mistake him for a celebrity, as Fernando Flores recalls.
We were in this hotel in Santiago, having lunch one day, and a woman arrived, older woman in English, said, "Oh, so beautiful, you look like Orson Welles."
Raul Espejo only needs to follow his nose to find Stafford's hotel room. The scent of his present is unmistakable.
I soon realized that I didn't need to ask for the number of his room, because I had clear that the smell of cigars would take me to his room without any hesitation or doubt. So the number of cigars he smoked